What's up, everybody? My name is Mike Lee, and I'd like to welcome you to the Mind Shift Lab. Each episode will bring you a guest to share exercises, strategies, and mindsets to help you create an internal shift that drives external results in business, the arts, sports, and life. I'm honored to dive in with our guest today, Pandit Dasa. Pandit is a mindful leadership expert, motivational keynote speaker, and author. Pandit helps organizations improve employee engagement, retention, and workplace happiness. He does this by inspiring organizations to create a mindful workplace culture by encouraging his audiences to lead by example, appreciate the contributions of their colleagues, communicate mindfully, and manage one's emotions. He helps individuals develop positive leadership qualities, lower stress and anxiety, increase focus and productivity, and boost emotional intelligence. Pandit, thanks so much for joining me today. I know you spent 15 years living as a monk, partially in India and Lower East Side in New York City. Why don't we start there and we will let the conversation evolve from there.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Mike, for having me on the show here. So basically, I did spend 15 years living as a monk. 90% of it was on the in New York City. Probably not the first city that comes to mind when you think of a place that you want to spend time as a monk. I also didn't expect that either. But how I got, you know, when I was living as a monk, people always ask me, why'd you become a monk? And now that I'm not a monk, people are asking me, why am I not a monk anymore? So let me just go ahead and, you know, answer both of those questions. I grew up in Southern California, actually. I think you're in that part of town now. My parents relocated there in 1980 from India. They moved from India to, migrated from India to the U.S. in 1980. They came over with little to no money. So one of the first things they did was they set up a small shop on the boardwalk of Venice Beach. that area of Venice Beach where that has all the basketball courts, it was right across there. So in case you happen to be walking by, you're like, oh my gosh, Pundit was here 40 years ago.
I know exactly where that is. Yeah. Right by my surf spot.
Yeah. So, you know, we didn't have much. They were just, you know, they were working really hard 7 days a week. And I was just like exploring American culture, you know, eating pizza, playing basketball, learning skateboarding, going to the beach. Just like that's what I was doing, running around the beach doing that. And with a lot of hard work and also with just a lot of luck, I think, which is kind of involved in everything we do, a little bit of luck. They established within about a 7-year period a multi-million dollar jewelry business in Los Angeles. And we got this beautiful home on the hills of Los Angeles, California, really began living that 90210 lifestyle, or, you know, the American dream, like that we like to call it. And so everything was great. We're living on the hills of Los Angeles, have a view overlooking all of downtown LA. So everything was good for a while. And just as everything in life is, has its ups and downs. In the early 1990s, my parents' jewelry business, the factory, caught on fire, and we lost the whole business. We ended up losing pretty much everything and went almost completely broke, actually. It's a longer story than that, but that's kind of what happened. And then at that time, my dad actually decides to explore new business opportunities, and he decides to explore them in post-communist Bulgaria. Now, I know you're wondering why the heck Bulgaria. It's a long story, and I'll tell you about my book at the end, because that's where people can find the whole story. So he went out there in post-communist Bulgaria in 1992, 1993. We packed up our bags, left LA behind for good. Now we're in Bulgaria. And to give you an idea what Bulgaria was like in 1992, 1993, no one spoke English. Like, it was like no one spoke any English. So you think they can, but you know, it's just the weirdest feeling when, like, when you talk to someone, no one understands what you're saying. And you're like, and you're the odd one out. So no one spoke English. Everything on TV was either in Russian or in Bulgarian. You know, all the movies were several years old, because I don't think they really allowed, like, American movies at that time. And, you know, taking a cab was difficult, and buying vegetables and fruits was difficult. Everything was challenging because of the language. So when everything, all my external distractions stopped and I didn't have anything to turn to, because remember, there was also no internet at that time.
Yeah.
You can imagine what the heck I was doing, right? What was I doing? When all my external distractions came to a halt, that's when I turned inward for the first time in my life. That's when my inward journey began, not in a monastery in Thailand or Burma or India, but in Bulgaria, post-communist Bulgaria. And that's when I sort of started to practice meditation, started reading this.
When you said it was the first time that you turned inward, what was that moment for you where you kind of realized that you needed to go within? And how old were you at that time?
I was 21 and okay. I had nothing else to turn to. Like right now we get stressed. What do we do? Okay. Like, all right, let me just do this.
100%.
Yeah. Like there was none of that.
Yeah.
There wasn't even internet. What to speak of smart devices. Like when I say I had nothing to do, like I remember just sitting on the balcony and just staring out, wondering when this ordeal of mine is going to end and when I'm actually going to be able to go back to the US. Like there was nothing else to do. And then I've seen my parents do some meditation. So I started also reading, you know, it was part of our family to some degree. And so I'm just like, okay, I guess this is what I got to do because there's no answers as to why this is happening to me and what did I do to deserve this? The two famous questions people ask in times of distress. And so I also started reading this one wisdom text from India called the Bhagavad Gita.
Yep.
It was read by Gandhi, Emerson, Thoreau, Einstein. So I started reading that, you know, when during these existential crises, when we go through, we start, you know, diving a little deeper and going sometimes turning inward and through spirituality. So I did. And I think that helped me get through that experience. Spent a couple years in Bulgaria. It was an unstable and somewhat unsafe country at that time. And so we came back to the U.S. to the East Coast. Then in 1999, I decided, you know, I'm just going to go explore my inner life, my spiritual life a little deeper. I went to a monastery in Mumbai, India. You know, here I am living with 40 monks, which I'd never done before. I'd never lived with any monks before. And, you know, we're waking up at 4 a.m, meditating for several hours a day. And the rest of the day is spent serving one another, serving the community. I thought I'd be there for like a month. I ended up spending 6 months in India, came back and moved into a monastery in New York City. Thought I'd spend another few months or maybe 6 months there. Ended up spending a total of 15 years living as a monk, most of it in New York City. So that's the short part. That's like in a nutshell of why I became a monk. And then about 6 years ago, I just felt like I wanted to take whatever I'd learned because I was doing a lot of lecturing and teaching on college campuses on mindfulness and things like that. So I did that for about 12, 13 years on college campuses.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to take that to another level. I wanted to take it to the corporate environment. 6 years ago, I left the monastic life and started speaking in organizations around the country and sometimes overseas as well. That's awesome. My whole life story there, Mike.
Awesome. I got a question for you that was brought to my mind when you were sharing your story. And I know, you know, everybody is going through a massive amount of adversity right now in their own way, shape, or form. And you said that the Bhagavad Gita helped you move through that period in when you were in Bulgaria, obviously going through a lot yourself. Is there anything that you pulled from that that might be helpful for people now that it was helpful for you at that time?
I can speak for a couple hours of things that I spoke from that would help people right now. I can speak for weeks on that. Well, one very important thing, the Bhagavad Gita says, I think it's in chapter 2 or 3, now my memory's failing, I think it's chapter 2, says that just as in this world, happiness, distress, and distress are both temporary. And it compares them to the summer and winter seasons. They both come and go. Right? Summer and winter come and go. Happiness and distress come and go. Nothing, for good or for bad, lasts forever in this world. So no matter how much someone is suffering now, it's just a cycle. It will end. It's just the way the world works. No matter how powerful a human being is, Jeff Bezos will die someday, right? LeBron James will die someday. Right? He just won't be able to play basketball someday. Like so you think you're on top of the world. At one point, you just can't do what you did. Everything has a cycle, right? The coronavirus, this thing will die someday. So nothing is permanent. can be taken as good news or bad news. I say neither. It's just the reality of life. And so that's one big message that, you know, I think can help people right now, but in any situation. And another thing, now that we're talking, you got me, you poked the Bhagavad Gita button in me, so I got to say something.
We could have a whole show on this. I've read it as well, so.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I've lectured on this for about 20 years. Now, the interesting thing is what the Bhagavad Gita says is, try to remain composed during distress and happiness. Keep your mind steady. What does that mean? So I think we've all seen the flame of a candle. Imagine a flame of a candle in a place where there's no wind. You know how it's so still, like you can't even, it won't even move? Like it almost doesn't look like fire, because when you look at fire, it's just like kind of crazy. The flame of a candle without any wind, it's just like still, right? You feel like you can touch it, like it doesn't look dangerous. But the slightest movement in the room will make it go flicker. And that's what our mind is like. It's like the flame of a candle. And what the Bhagavad Gita is saying is that we want to try to remain, try, like a flame of a candle. Even if there's stuff happening, that we are remaining steady and focused and grounded. And that we're not kind of like a little movement here, you know, oh, COVID. Okay, like, oh, this, oh. So it's saying, no, that stuff is always going to be there. The world is designed like a big washing machine. It's going to spin. So it's always on a spin cycle. We can learn to be a little bit more calm and composed during all of that. And if we can, we'll move through life more stress-free than we can imagine.
Yeah, I love that candle analogy. That I've never heard that one before. The one that that's been taught to me is the one around comparing, would you rather be an oak tree or would you rather be a bamboo tree? If you're an oak tree, you might be strong and sturdy, but eventually that storm comes. And if you resist the change, it's going to knock you over. It's going to break the roots. It's going to knock the tree down. But the bamboo trees are the ones that are able to withstand the change and the adversity and the chaos. And they move with the change in chaos and adversity. And when the storm is done, they are the ones left standing, and the oak trees are not. They're the ones that are broken. So that's the one that I have used when it comes to how we want to be moving through change. I love the candle analogy, though. I've never heard that one before.
That's right from the Bhagavad Gita, actually.
The bamboo tree one is, or the candle?
The candle one.
Oh, the candle. Okay, yeah. No, that's a great one. So sticking with this topic of adversity and change, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges that we all have with change is not so much change itself, but our resistance to change. And like we talked about in the beginning, like change is literally in the definition of life. If you look up life in the dictionary, change is in the definition. But I think a lot of us go through life in resistance to change, which only brings about emotional suffering. And obviously right now we are going through a lot of change, whether we like it or not. What would you say to somebody that is struggling because they are resisting the change, they're resisting the next normal that we're going to be living in?
So one of my friends who's a monk still, he's been a monk for like 20 plus years. He said something really nice. He's like, if you can control something, there's no need to worry. And if you can't control something, there's no need to worry. Because you can't control it. There's nothing you can do. Let it happen, you know? And if you can control it, then what you got to worry about? Because it's under your control. So I would say to that person, remember that one quote. And that would be helpful. And, you know, there's also this nice quote from Steve Jobs. You can only connect the dots looking back. You can't connect the dot looking forward. And that each time we go through something difficult, or obviously that difficult moment is, yeah, it's stressing us out and it's maybe making us lose sleep, but it's also showing us, it's kind of holding up a mirror for us to look inside. Because it's during those times we can see like, wow, this is the kind of reaction that comes out of me. when I get stressed, when I get anxious. This is what comes out of me. This is what I turn into from like Dr. Jekyll and, you know, Hyde, right? It's like, is that what I turn into? So I think one powerful thing is the changes and the anxieties brought about by changes that we don't want, what changes we didn't ask for, changes we don't like, changes we want to resist. A powerful thing happens is that we are forced to look in the mirror in that moment and see the other self, our bad dog sort of coming out and just barking up a storm. And we like to, you know, oftentimes we like to believe that, you know, oh yeah, like I'm so zen now. I can handle anything. I can do, yeah, I'm good. I figured it out. I'm so wise. I'm so mature. Yeah, I've got it figured out. And then all of a sudden, you know, stuff hits the fan. And when that happens, the maturity, the wisdom, the calm, not all of it, obviously, but some of it can really go out the window. And then you realize, oh, I got work to do still. I thought I was like, you know, turned into the next Dalai Lama, but I guess that hasn't quite happened yet, you know? So I think that adversity and resistance has changed. One powerful thing that it does, it gives us an opportunity to really look at ourselves in the mirror and see how much more work we have left to do on ourselves. And to just know that, you know, whatever challenges are coming in our life, we have to really be able to see them as, just like in school, if you don't take your final exam, you don't graduate to the next class, to the next grade. And so every test, every difficulty, every situation, scenario that involves change and anxiety and stress, think of it as a midterm in your life that's coming up, or an exam. And if we don't pass it, how do we move ourselves to the next grade or the next level? And so it's interesting to take those moments and in the moment realize I'm getting tested right now and this is going to help me grow. I don't know how it's going to help me grow because we can't do that looking forward. But a year or 2 years from now, we're going to look back and say, oh, man, I wouldn't be able to do this right now if it wasn't for that stuff. That crazy COVID that happened, you know, that helped me in this way. But we won't get that realization maybe till maybe a year or two or even three from now.
Yeah, I think it's super important to at least approach the challenges that show up with a sense of gratitude. It's incredibly difficult to do, but I look back on every single challenge I've ever had in my life. I always look back on it with gratitude. And if we can go into the next one or the one that we're in right now with gratitude, it's going to give us a better ability to navigate that challenge with that mindset that we're going to learn something, we're going to grow from it, and we're going to be a better person, a better leader, a better business person on the other side of it if we can frame up the problem that we're facing right now with that approach.
Yeah, I mean, gratitude can really just shift our entire mindset and approach to everything. You know, we're not supposed to just be grateful for the good things. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not, it's, gratitude isn't just like, oh, thank you. You know, I'm so grateful I got a better job. Oh, I'm so grateful I got a bonus. Oh, I'm so grateful that my kids got into the college of their choice. That's all nice. And that's easy. The real test of gratitude is, like you said, when we are grateful for the, you know, the speed bumps in life. When you're going 55 miles an hour and you didn't realize a city put in the speed bump. Right? You hit it, bam, your car hits the, you know, takes off for a little bit. And who knows, your head hits the steering wheel and you get all shaken up. Okay, so somehow we got to find a way to be grateful in the middle of all that. Or maybe a little bit afterwards when we've kind of recovered, you know?
Yeah.
Like, okay, that was tough, you know, but maybe I was meant to go through this for a reason which I don't understand. And I think we just need to have the humility to understand we're not going to understand why we're going through something in the moment.
Yeah.
That's something we just have to accept.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could try, I know I've tried to do that like in the middle of a really painful thing, and many painful things have happened this year. I'm like, okay, I don't understand how this is going to help, but I'm grateful that this is happening. I don't even know why. Am I crazy for saying this? No, I'm not. I'm grateful because a year from now, I'm going to realize that was a powerful moment. That suffering was powerful. In the moment, it was just suffering, but later I would be able to reconnect the dot. And even now when I look back and things that happened to me in February and March and April, there's a certain, now that it's over, the worst of it for me and whatever things I went through, I'm like, wow, that was actually good. It was needed. You know, I learned so much about myself through those situations. So gratitude has the power and the, you know, yeah, it has the power to literally just flip everything around and turn any difficult situation into an opportunity to just kind of growth opportunity. That's what it really does.
Yeah, for sure. We're definitely on the same page there. Hey, everybody, Mike Lee here. I know if you're listening to our show, that means you're a bold, driven, and future-focused leader looking to challenge the status quo and get to the next level, which is why I've created a guide that blends the worlds of sports performance psychology with mindfulness on how to lock in and consistently deliver world-class, resilient performance in any arena of business or life. You can grab your copy by heading over to mindshiftlabs.com/performance. That's mindshiftlabs.com/performance. Let's get back to the show. Let's shift gears here for a second. We'll actually go back to something that you brought up. You said that the COVID-19 pandemic has really brought out, I think you used the word ugly dog, or other people might say your shadow self, or whatever your unconscious that is coming to the surface because we are in heightened states of stress. And one thing that I think that's happened is COVID-19 has not created a mental health epidemic in our country. It's just brought to the surface what has already been there for a long, long, long time. What are some practical things that people can put into place, put into to action, implement right now that will, I hate using the word coping skills, but that can help them move through some of the challenges that they're facing right now, whether it's the uncertainty or anxiety or stress that they are experiencing at an unprecedented level?
Well, I think one is that we really do need to just, you know, one phrase that I like to use is that self-care is not selfish. And I like to borrow the phrase from the airline industry that put your own oxygen mask on first before helping others. So that is not selfish during a time like this. Mm-hmm. Because if we lose consciousness, then we can't put anyone else's mask on at that point. So first, we need to be breathing before we can help someone else. So I think that, you know, self-care is of the utmost importance. And what is self-care? It's a variety of things. I think we need to, in terms of self-care, I think we need to first and foremost make sure we're getting enough sleep at night, because our entire body is going to just stop functioning properly if we're not getting enough sleep. There's research. There's so much research, but basically some of the research says that lack of sleep can affect our mood, memory, health, and judgment.
Yeah.
Like, what else is there? Mood, memory, health, and judgment. You lose those, we're not even human being, basically, you know? So we have to make sure that we are getting enough sleep. And, you know, disconnecting from these things at a certain time so that we do have enough time to wind down and go to sleep, actually. Yeah. And then we're not just, you know, turning off the blue light on our phone and the settings. You can go turn off the blue light because the blue light keeps you awake as well. So it's automatic. And there's a way you can just go in and shut it off. It's automatically shuts it off at a certain time and it turns it back on at a certain time. You can set that, you know. And so I think these are some things, you know, I think we need to, like we plan anything else in life, I think we need to actually plan when we're going to sleep and plan when we're going to stop all the stuff that prevents us from sleeping. Like, okay, if you want to sleep at 11 o'clock, then you should start winding down by like 9:30 or something. Like, okay, by after 9:30, I'm only going to do things that are really calming for me. Like maybe reading a book, maybe taking a hot bath, maybe drinking some like chamomile tea or something like that. Like, or soft music, like, or meditation. So finding things that will soothe me, calm me, because then when you get a good night's sleep, you know, at least for me, I notice it literally for me right away. If I've had a bad night's sleep, my mood is just down like a good chunk of the day, until I take a nap in the afternoon. Then I'm like, oh my God, it was really, because sometimes I would have that. I'm like, what's going on? Why am I feeling down? Oh, it's lack of sleep. And then I read the research on it. I'm like, oh, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. So sleep is one thing. Another thing I think is we do, because we are stuck at home, we've got stuff in the pantry. And it's probably not the healthiest stuff that we've got in there, sugar-coated stuff to make us feel comfort, you know, comfort foods, give us a quick lift. I think we got to be careful of what we're eating and when we're eating and how much we're eating. I'm guilty of it, all of this myself. I've got plenty of stuff in the pantry. I try not to have too much stuff in there because, you know, when you get those times when you're just kind of not doing much, what do? You're like, let me go grab something to eat. Got to do something. You know, that like boredom eating sort of. So I think that just like we're scheduling and paying attention to our sleep, we also need to pay attention to when we're scheduling our meals. And I would really recommend, highly recommending now and more than ever before, that we should all consider, consider a much more plant-based diet. We really should. And I think COVID-19 is related to like, just like the meat industry, at least, you know, there is some connection to that, right? So I think that we do need to, because you know, there's gazillion articles and research showing how red meat causes like leads to things like cancer and higher blood pressure and obesity and all kinds of things. You know, processed food, processed meats also are really, really like they're like almost carcinogenic according to the World Health Organization. So if we can switch to a more plant-based diet, if not completely, but at least try to increase your intake of fruits and vegetables, try to cook your own meals, try to eat fresh food. These kinds of things will help us remain healthier. And if our body is healthy, our mind will be healthy. If our mind is healthy, our body will be healthy. There is that connection that we can't ignore. And of course, I think just having positive relationships, you know, connecting with friends, connecting with family, connecting with coworkers on a personal level is one of the best ways to reduce our stress. And of course, doing meditation, having a mindfulness practice is invaluable as well, combined with all of these things. These are different ways that we can actually deal with or cope with all the, you know, the craziness that's happening around us.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you were talking about before with sleep and really setting up your day and how it affects your state. And I think right now, a big challenge that a lot of leaders are facing is they have to solve challenges every day. They got to solve problems every single day. And we think that we can go right into that problem-solving mode. And really what you're saying is the first step is to set up our emotional state. There's a book, I can't remember the name of it, but it's written by, you've probably read it or maybe even know him, I don't know. Krishnaji and Pretaji, they wrote a book called The Four Secrets, I believe, or something like that. Basically, they talk about we experience life in two different states. We're in a beautiful state of love, of joy, of service, of creativity, or we're in a suffering state of negativity, of anger, depression, resentment, stress, whatever it is. And really the first step every day is to set ourselves up to be in a beautiful state. And when we're in those beautiful states, we're going to be more creative. We're going to solve more problems. We're going to have better relationships. And all of these will help drive our businesses forward, even in the middle of a global pandemic, if we can access these states. And I think I just wanted to reiterate your point about getting enough sleep and setting up our day the night before. With a good night's sleep and really learning how to schedule it and to shut down our days earlier. That's one thing that I struggle with a ton is I just go and go and go. And by the time I look at it, it's 10, 11 o'clock at night. And it's no wonder I don't sleep that well. So I have found when I start shutting down at 6, 7 o'clock, I definitely get a better night's sleep and my next day is better.
Yeah. And you know, it's not just our sleep that we want to plan. Here's another interesting idea. Why not plan how I'm going to start my morning?
Yep.
Like plan it the night before. Like, you know, without a plan, things are chaotic. It's like, how many times have you just gotten in your car, turned it on, and just not knowing where you're going? That's hardly ever the case, right? Maybe you've done that once in a while. Like, okay, let me just drive. Like, it's even hard to do that. Like, you have some idea in the back of your mind where you're going. Like, I want to go to the beach. I want to go to the mountains somewhere. You're not just going to, like, drive. I mean, I don't know. I've never done that, really. You know, just get in the car and go and not knowing where I'm going. So if we don't plan how we're going to start the day, then it could start in all kinds of ways. And one thing I would suggest is start by not picking this up. Because, you know, you wake up, you're just like, you know, like that, right? So let's try not to do that. Because right there, there's all kinds of news. You don't want to wake up. And the first thing you see is that the Capitol building was stormed, right? Like, you don't want to start your day with a storm. Like, that news isn't going anywhere. So you could check it an hour later after breakfast. Like, you don't need to know that in that moment. Like, that doesn't affect your, unless you're like the guy who's supposed to be on security there, and then maybe you do need to, like, I gotta get to work, man. Look what's going on. Go away and look what happened, you know? So other than that, you just need to brush your teeth, meditate, do some gratitude practice, take a shower, eat breakfast, and then you can see what's going on in the day. So I think how we start our day is really important, but it also does require just a little planning the night before, like, what am I going to do when I wake up? I'm not going to pick up my phone. I'm not going to, like, just know what you're not going to do and what you'd like to do. And then imagine how good you'll feel when you actually get up and do those things that you know are good for you. And that's the way to start the day in one sense, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think I read in a book by Darren Hardy a few years ago, and he talks about this. He calls it bookending your days. And you don't know what's going to show up in the middle of your day, but you can control how you start it and how you end it. And if we start our days on our phone, in our email, we're dealing with things that are out of our control, and it puts us into a reactive state versus a state where we are operating with more intention. And, you know, I was talking to a CEO of a company, and we were talking about things like, he was pushing back on the fact that he had to check his email right away in the morning. And I said to him, if there's a fire that you absolutely have to put out, does somebody send you an email about that, or maybe a text, or do they pick up the phone and call you if it's something you need to deal with immediately? And he kind of had some awareness around it. He's like, yeah, you're right. Actually, you know, if there's a fire that I got to put out, somebody's calling me and I'm going to get on the phone. But if we're going through our emails and everything, it just puts us in that state of reactivity where we're not as much in control of how we want to start our days and use our most vital energy in the mornings at the start of our days.
Yeah, because what happens is, you know, as soon as we start checking those stressful emails, it's triggering the cortisol levels immediately. So it's like, think about it. You're still in bed and you're already stressing out. That should tell us something. Like, I'm in bed, my eyes just opened, and like 3 minutes later, my cortisol is like already going. Like, wait, can I just wait 30 minutes before I let it go? Can I just wake up properly? It's like on a cold winter day, you turn on your car and you floor it. Like, okay, it'll work, but you know, you're just like depleting its capacity to function for a long period of time. It's just like the engine hasn't warmed up. Nothing's warmed up. You turn it on at like a 30 degree or 20 degree, and you're like, yeah, I'm just going to go for it. You know? It'll go. It's just going to end like way faster than it should, the whole thing. Yeah, we want to start our car like that, this car every morning like that, you know? But then that's kind of what we're doing, you know?
Yeah. Let's shift gears here just for a second, and we got to wrap things up here quick. But mindfulness is top of mind for everybody right now. It's probably never been more talked about in the media, never been more popular, something that you've taught and practiced for a long, long time. How do you define it, and what are some ways, how do you define it? What are some ways that it can benefit you, and then how could you put it into practice?
Well, I think one simple way to define it is that, you know, keeping our mind in the present moment, because our mind is constantly going from past to future. We know that. It's remembering something that happened a year ago, and then it's worrying about what's going to happen a year from now. So it's kind of like a set of windshield wipers, you know, back and forth, back and forth. The mindfulness sort of helps us stay in the present moment, and it also helps us get in touch with our emotions, thoughts and emotions. And I think that is the key thing to understand, keeping us in the present, keeping us focused. Because, right, we know that all the worrying about the past and the future, it doesn't accomplish much. It just causes more stress. And so mindfulness can help us become aware that, oh, I'm worrying about the future. Let me not worry. Let me come back to the present, because that worrying is just increasing my cortisol level. So we can actually control that by coming back into the present moment. The present moment is the only moment we have any control over, or potentially some control over.
Yeah.
So the way we can practice it, you know, it doesn't have to be a long 20, 30 minute thing each day. Sometimes people think, oh my God, now they're going to tell us to do it for 20 minutes. No, I say that you can start with just like 3 minutes a day.
Yeah.
Right? And it can be as simple as taking 10 deep breaths while you're in bed, before getting out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
taking a moment to think of something you're grateful for or someone that you're grateful for. You could do the same thing in the middle of the day or before a meeting or after a meeting or before you close your day. So just like I would sometimes, I can even recommend that just the way you have three meals a day, why not do three 3-minute practices a day? I mean, who can't do a 3-minute practice in the first third of their day?
Right.
How can we not pull out 3 hours, 3 minutes within an 8-hour period? You know, if we can't, then I think we need to reevaluate our whole life.
Right.
Something's gone wrong here. So I think that, you know, just taking some deep breaths, feeling something, grateful for something, is kind of enough to start a mindfulness practice. Something as simple as that.
Yeah, yeah. So why would you say as a leader it's important to show up in a mindful way? What's it? I think it's beneficial for everybody, but from a leadership perspective, it can be incredibly impactful. What would be a reason why somebody in a leadership position might want to pick up a practice right now?
Well, I think one of the things that mindfulness can really help us do, like I said, it helps us become more self-aware of who we are, where we need to be. It can also gradually help us understand where I'm at now and where I need to be. Mm-hmm. It can help us with humility recognize that gap, which can be sometimes scary. And it can also help us manage our ego, manage our emotions. And if you're in a leadership position, you really need to be able to manage your emotions. You can't be yelling at people across the room and just like embarrassing them in front of everyone. It really can help us check our emotions, but it's something that needs to be done on a regular, consistent basis for it to really have an impact. You know, one off, great, it'll do something for you in that moment. But it's just like you go to the gym once, like I want to get healthy. I'm just going to go to the gym once. Like that's not going to do it.
Yeah.
I want to get healthy, so I'm just going to eat salad today and never again. Like, okay, wait, that's not going to do it. Consistency, you know, regular implementation of any good habit is what's really going to make a difference. So the more we practice it on a regular basis, even if it's a short spurt of 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, on a regular basis, it'll help us recognize our emotions. We'll get more in touch with our triggers, like, oh, I'm about to get angry. Okay, and now in that moment, you can turn your thermostat down. Like, okay, I can turn it down. So it helps us recognize that, oh, if the thermostat's rising, I can turn it back down. It actually helps us get in touch with that. And how powerful is that as a leader? Like, I mean, who wants to see a leader blow up and explode in a meeting? And it's just like, it looks so ugly. It doesn't foster teamwork and trust. It actually takes away from all of that. So yeah. I think it is absolutely crucial and vital that, you know, for those in a leadership position in some capacity to start practicing mindfulness.
Yeah, yeah. And it really amplifies and what you talk about in your mindful leadership programs, that a mindful leader is somebody who leads by example. And if we don't have the self-awareness of who we are and the emotions we're exhibiting and the behaviors that we're demonstrating, we are not going to be able to model what we want our people to, or how we want our people to show up, because that's a something that they just pick up unconsciously. And it, you know, just speaks to the actions speak louder than words. And that might sound super cliche, but it is 100% true. And it's really a lot of the little things as a leader, being a mindful leader, just showing up and leading yourself every day can go so far. And mindfulness can definitely help people with that. What would you say to leaders right now who are leading their organization through a crisis?
What I would say to them is be a little bit more personal with your folks. Reach out to them and have a non-work-related conversation. Let them know you care. Ask them how they're doing. Be compassionate and be flexible if for some reason they're not able to perform at the level that they were.
Yeah.
Because they may be going through a lot. So yeah. A little compassion and thoughtfulness can really let the individual know that you actually care. And when people feel that, they'll actually go above and beyond the call of duty to get things done and to help the organization grow.
100%. We could go on and on about that. Where can people find you?
So LinkedIn is a good way. You know, just look me up, Pandit Dasa. or my website. Actually, what you can do is I'm going to show you a copy of my book. Can I do that?
Yeah, for sure.
This is my new book.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about
So actually, if you go to closing, the book is called Closing the Apps. And, you know, there's like a bunch of apps in this person's head that we're trying to close.
Yeah.
If we close out the apps that we don't need, then we can stay more focused on the ones we do. So if you go to closingtheapps.com, that actually takes you to my website.
Awesome.
Which is fundedasa.com. And then you can see my the different workshops that I've done. And then you over there, when you go to closingtheapps.com, you'll also see my first book that I did, Urban Monk, about how and why I became a monk. That's the full story right there. I just gave you an abbreviated version here. So these are my two books. But yeah, you can go to closingtheapps.com, check out the book, check out what talks I'm doing, and reach out if you have any questions.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much for taking the time out of your day to join us and share your wisdom and knowledge with everybody who's listening in. I look forward to continuing this conversation with you soon offline, and I hope you have an incredible rest of your day.
Thanks, Mike. It was a great pleasure talking to you again.
What's up, guys? Thanks for taking the time to listen to the show today. If you enjoyed the episode, we'd greatly appreciate a 5-star rating on iTunes because it's how we spread the word about the show. Also, remember to grab your copy of Locked In, a digital guide on how to unlock world-class resilient performance by heading over to mindshiftlabs.com/performance. That's mindshiftlabs.com/performance. We'll see you next week. Never champion, definition of a champion, no. Never for titles before survival, the champion, a team road.